Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the post-Super Tuesday electoral landscape ahead for Donald Trump, the increasingly likely Republican presidential candidate, and Hillary Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner. Alan Lichtman, a political historian at American University and author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, joins us to discuss this wildly unpredictable election year and how it relates to his book, The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. Alan Lichtman's predicting system that has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Then George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at UC Berkeley, joins us to discuss his work in identifying the authoritarian patriarchal strain in Republican politics in contrast to the yielding matriarchal nature of Democratic politics and how his theories are coming to life with the emergence of a likely Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton presidential race in this election year. We'll examine why the Democrats continue to underestimate Trump and how they might be able to blunt his momentum. Then finally, we'll explore some historical comparisons to a possibly divided Republican Party heading into the 2016 elections and the election of 1860, when the country was divided over slavery, with Abraham Lincoln's Democratic opponents splitting into three parties, thus ensuring the election of the anti-slavery Republican candidate. David Reynolds, a distinguished professor at the City University of New York Graduate Center and author of Lincoln's Selected Writings, joins us to discuss this and other historical examples of divisive and vitriolic election campaigns. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
And Alan, in this wildly unpredictable 2016 election year, which has actually been going on for some time into 2015 as well, I guess, and we've got 8 months to go, your prediction system is going to be really put to the test, isn't it?
That's right. I still haven't made a call. There are still things up in the air. Three critical factors remain to be decided. Will there be a real protracted contest for the Democratic nomination, always a very bad thing for the party holding the White House, one of my keys. The last time the party holding the White House survived a truly long, bitter, closely contested nomination fight, you have to go back two centuries to 1880 and James Garfield, who won by 0.1% in the popular vote. The second thing, of course, is will Michael Bloomberg mount a third party or independent campaign, another negative for the party in power, particularly for someone like Bloomberg, who is naturally going to draw votes from the Democrats, not the Republicans. And thirdly, will there be recognition of a foreign policy triumph on the part of the incumbent Democrats? I believe, and most experts believe, that the Iran nuclear treaty represents a real milestone, avoiding a nuclear arms race and maybe even a nuclear war in the Middle East. But so far, that has yet to sink in with the general public.
But isn't there also the possibility of, and this is being floated by the so-called Republican establishment, that they might organize some kind of alternative candidate, not Bloomberg, but somebody else to run as some kind of Republican independent?
Yeah, that would be unprecedented, really, in modern American history for the challenging party to split and run a third party. Obviously, if that happened, it would likely give the election to the Democrat, because when you split your vote, there are not enough votes left for the regular nominee to win. I don't think the Republicans are going to commit that kind of self-immolation, but so far they've shown themselves to be impervious to logic.
Well, what's the historical precedent then in terms of whether the Republicans can avoid the down-ticket damage that many of the Republican analysts are now predicting that Trump will cause? In 1972, of course, McGovern got wiped out, but the Democrats maintain control of the House and Senate. Is there a mechanism for the Republicans to do that?
I think that's going to be very, very difficult. I would turn more for a Republican president to Barry Goldwater in 1964, a candidate on the real extreme fringes of the right who was wiped out by Lyndon Johnson. The Democrats did very well from top to bottom. It's very difficult to run away from the candidate of your own party. You risk looking weak. You risk looking divisive. That's not a strong position from which to run, particularly for embattled Republican senators in Democratic-leaning states like Illinois and Pennsylvania.
So let's turn this conversation on its head and discuss the possibility of a Trump presidency, because let's face it, this candidate has caught everybody by surprise and continues to do so, and I think you underestimate him at your peril.
I agree with that. I've never underestimated him. Back in October, I went on television and I said, as always, the conventional wisdom pundits are wrong. They're always wrong. And they're wrong about Donald Trump. He is not going to fade because he's saying a lot of things that appeal to the Republican base that other candidates are too cowardly to say. You know, you've got all of these Republicans pointing fingers. If only the Republican establishment had taken aim at Donald Trump earlier, maybe they could have stopped him. If only Marco Rubio was a better candidate. That's all a lot of nonsense. Who is propelling Trump? It's the Republican voters, not any flaw in the Republican strategy. It's the voters who are doing this. And there's no cure to what the voters are doing in the Republican base. And that's where all of this talk and all of this consternation on the part of the Republican so-called establishment is misplaced.
But it seems, Alan Lichtman, that this year is a bad year for any status quo politician. That, for example, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton wants to improve the system, but Bernie Sanders wants to change it. And that's what's resonating and getting people excited. And it's the same as happening on the other side, where this outsider, Donald Trump, is going to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but he's certainly going to throw out the bathwater.
Well, maybe so. And, you know, Sanders has done surprisingly well. I give him a lot of credit. He's raised important issues. He's excited young people within the Democratic Party. And, you know, he's won some important primaries, but there is no path to a Sanders nomination. The key for the Democrats is not whether or not Sanders can be nominated. That's now off the table. Hillary Clinton's already halfway to the nomination. And, you know, she'll do very well in big states like New York and California. So the question is, will Sanders enthusiastically, not pro forma, endorse Hillary Clinton for president and sustain and maintain some of the enthusiasm that he has generated? Let's face it, you know, from Sanders' point of view or from the point of view of anyone supporting Sanders, Hillary Clinton is infinitely preferable to any of the Republicans on every issue across the board. She is vastly closer to what the Sanders supporters represent than any Republican.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. So in terms of the historical record, it seems to me that candidates of late, and particularly the candidates running in this particular race on the Republican side, they've been clamoring, the so-called establishment has been clamoring for, well, actually Carson did drop out today, but they've also been trying to get Kasich to drop out, and he's refusing to do so. And now I assume they'll try to get Rubio to drop out because Cruz seems to be cruising ahead of him. But that, to me, indicates the lack of party discipline, for want of a better description, that the parties just aren't able to tell their candidates what to do anymore.
The party, so-called the party, and, you know, that's a very vague term because, you know, we don't have party membership in this country. We don't have a party directorate. You know, this is not the Communist Party of Russia. We have a Democratic and Republican National Committee, but they really don't have any power and they don't influence any votes. So there's no way there is a so-called party that can tell these candidates what they should do and what they should not do. And let us never underestimate the arrogance of power on the part of these candidates. However much the odds may be stacked against them, they are still believing lightning is going to strike, the miracle is going to happen, and therefore there is no reason for them to drop out of the race. And let's not forget, for a lot of mainstream Republicans, the choice between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz is, you know, whether you want to take arsenic or cyanide. Ted Cruz is roundly hated by his fellow Republicans, and they don't really believe that Ted Cruz is the answer, that, you know, he has a really good chance of beating Hillary Clinton. They'd much rather rally around Marco Rubio, but Marco Rubio has won one out of 15 contests, and it's, a, you know, not one of the big state contests. He hasn't proven that he has electability within the Republican base. Now, the way you get Marco Rubio out is not by anything the so-called Republican Party or establishment is going to do. That's a myth. Marco Rubio will be forced out if he loses his home state of Florida on March 15th, not far off.
And that's what the polls indicate. So is there a way out then for the, again, I think we're talking about a somewhat mythical establishment, but, you know, the pundits keep saying that the Republican establishment is having a heartburn at the moment. So is there a way out for them to avoid?
There really isn't a way out for them unless Donald Trump starts losing. That's not impossible. You know, voters are fickle, but it doesn't seem very likely. You know, they have this kind of doomsday scenario where Trump goes into the Republican convention this summer with a lead, but not quite enough delegates to command a majority. And they have a so-called brokered convention and turn to Rubio or who knows whom. They can turn to anyone. But that is not a positive scenario for the Republicans. It's going to make them look like they're denying the will of the voters, a very weak position to run a presidential campaign from. And Trump may well run on the Constitution Party ticket and divide the Republicans. He has kind of indicated that if they so-called steal the nomination from him, he is not going to sit quietly and do that. So that is not a real positive scenario. None of the scenarios look good for the Republicans right now. And again, it's the voters who are doing this, you know, not anyone else.
But it's not a lot of voters, frankly. And this is what's so extraordinary about our political system is it goes on forever. There's no national primary. So they stagger these primaries. The only real winners, as far as I can tell, are people like Les Moonves, the head of CBS News, who's, you know, rubbing his hands together with glee at how much money they're making. And we've got 8 months to go. Is there a possibility, Alan Lichtman, that the American people are just going to get tired of this? I mean, I think a lot of people have been somewhat appalled by the tenor of the debate on the Republican side with all kinds of crude name-calling and insults. And then, you know, it's sort of turned into a kind of reality TV cage fight. So presumably Trump is now sort of looking ahead to the general election, and quite frankly, he may run as a liberal Democrat, and particularly his foreign policy may end up being to the left of Hillary Clinton's. But nevertheless, don't you think there must be a fatigue factor in here?
Of course there's a fatigue factor, but what's the voter to do other than to sit home? And that is not a very good alternative. But you're right, the Republican debate has been nothing if not puerile. My favorite comment that I heard about it was that it has devolved into a petty student council contest. But if the students were to be making the kinds of comments that the Republican candidates are making about one another, they probably would have been expelled from school. And that's how bad it really has become.
But there's no authority to expel them except the American people. And I guess, what's your reading on the pulse of the people? Are they're obviously angry, and Trump is feeding into that or feeding off that, I guess. So it's really quite a puzzle to figure out whether Hillary's strategy of appealing to the better angels of our nature is going to work as opposed to Donald Trump's slash and burn strategy.
Well, Donald Trump Trump's slash-and-burn strategy works well in Republican primaries, the same way that Barry Goldwater's musing about using nuclear weapons in Vietnam back in 1964 and questioning Social Security worked well with the Republican conservative base. But you got to face the general election, and the general election electorate is, if nothing else, pretty moderate. You know, it's slightly left, slightly right of center, but it's not nearly at any one of the other extremes. So I think Trump is going to have to pivot if he wants to have a chance, and he's perfectly capable of doing that. The truth is, here's really why the Republicans hate Donald Trump. It's nothing to do with his not, you know, disavowing David Duke in time or anything like that. It has to do with the fact that he's uncontrollable and unpredictable. Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio are totally predictable. You know what they're going to do if they're president. Trump is an absolute wild card. He has been all over the map during his long life politically. He is a force unto himself, and who knows what positions he might take as president. He might revert to some of his old, more liberal principles back when he was a big supporter of the Clintons. That's what really terrifies the so-called Republican establishment. It's nothing to do with any of these things they're actually talking about.
But already he's indicated in remarks about foreign policy that he is, I think, to the left of Hillary Clinton on not wanting to pick a fight with the Russians, wanting to get out of Syria, in fact, even supporting the Russian initiative in Syria, and so on.
I mean, could be. But I mean, who knows?
Right.
You don't know with Trump because he's so vague about his policies. He is so mercurial. He is so unpredictable. You know, he said all that, but he's also said, you know, we're going to go around the world beating up on every other nation and exercising our powers. So you just don't know what you're going to get with a Trump presidency. You can't go by exactly what he says at any one time because, as Richard Nixon used to say, it can become inoperable at any time.
Well, just in closing, Alan Lichtman, there's always been an assumption on the part of Democrats that if only more people voted in the elections, and we are pretty much somewhat shameful in terms of our turnout compared to the other advanced democracies. But the assumption is that, of course, that if only more people voted, they'd vote on the left. But Trump is indicating that he's drawing people out in a kind of a right-wing populism is emerging. And he even the other day said how much he loves poorly educated voters. So is there a possibility that that whole theory is wrong, that if a lot more people voted, they may vote on the right rather than on the left?
I think that theory is not wrong. I think the Democrats will benefit if there's a higher turnout because the non-voters tend to be minority. They tend to be young. And they do tend to be lower income, but they tend to be much more of the Democratic base. In 2012, the preference, according to a Pew study of the non-voters, was 70% for Barack Obama, you know, who won with about 52%. So I don't think a rising turnout is going to benefit Republicans. I think it will benefit Democrats. But I don't, for all of the Sturm und Drang you see in these primaries, I don't expect this to be an especially high turnout general election. I think it's to be right, you know, in the mid 50% range, like we saw in the last election. I don't see a sudden surge in turnout because both candidates, Hillary Clinton, presuming it's Donald Trump, also have their problems. There are a lot of people, and this can change, who said they're not going to vote for either one of them.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining why the Democrats continue to underestimate Trump and how they might be able to blunt his momentum.
From the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Failing. And his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, George, your work has often identified the authoritarian patriarchal strain in Republican politics in contrast to the yielding matriarchal nature of Democratic politics, and it would seem now that your theories are coming to life with the emergence of a likely Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton presidential race. So it couldn't be more stark, in fact, to my mind.
Well, it's very stark, but most people pick out one little thing and don't see the whole picture, which is quite complex. The strict father model of the family, which is the best way to understand all this, gives you a conservative moral perspective, but it has complications, and especially complications in terms of politics. So to understand it, you have to know a little bit about those complications and a little bit about some things that the Democrats don't know about in terms of how the brain works. So to get into it, it's going to take a few minutes, and let me just say a couple of things about it. First, there is no middle in American politics. Everybody who says move to the middle and so on, there isn't any such thing. What you have in what are called moderates are people who are mostly either conservative and partly liberal or liberal and partly conservative. And the partly has to do with different particular issues that they're concerned with. So, there are moderate conservatives who have certain issues that, look liberal, and others who have different ones that look liberal, and the same thing on the other side. But there is no ideology of the moderate. There's nothing that all moderates believe in. There's no view of just moderates, period. That doesn't exist. And the reason that it looks like that exists is that the pollsters put artificial bell curves on their data and always have a middle, which isn't there. So that's something to be aware of. And then that raises another question. If a lot of people, and I think perhaps most people, have these two different versions, they have what are called biconceptualism, that is, they're strongly one and partly the other, how can they have both moral systems in their brain at once? And the answer from neuroscience is very simple. Any ideology that you have or any idea that you have is carried out by neural circuitry. And a common circuit in the brain is what is called mutual inhibition. The activation of one turns off the other. And the stronger one gets, the weaker the other gets. So the question is, how does that work? What strengthens these things? And the answer is language. Language that makes use of one moral system rather than another. The conservatives have been taking advantage of this for decades. Many decades, and they have a communication system that progressives do not have around the country. They have over 150,000 people out there talking regularly on their issues, trained by the Leadership Institute and having a booking agency for them on radio and TV and so on. And so their messages have gotten out there. And they have strengthened the partially conservative progressives. They've taken people who are like union members but strict fathers at home, things like that, and made them more conservative by just using the language over and over and over. So that has happened, and it's something that you need to take note of. Given that, you need to understand what the conservative moral system is like. It's a strict father system, and it's based on a strict father view of the family. And it goes like this. The father is in charge of the family. The father's authority cannot be questioned. you know, his spouse is supposed to support him and support his values, and he is supposed to know best. Father knows best. That is, you know, he knows right from wrong, and his job is to make sure that his spouse and children, especially his children, learn right from wrong. And the way that he does this with children is by punishing them when they do wrong, so that to avoid the punishment, they'll try to discipline themselves, not to do what feels good, but to do what he tells them, which is assumed to be right. If they get that discipline, there's a consequence, which is they're supposed to be able to go out in the world and become prosperous, since they're disciplined. Therefore, if they're not prosperous, that means they're not moral and deserve their poverty. And this is a common theme in conservative thought. It is personal, not social responsibility, but personal responsibility. You are responsible for what you do and how well you do. Now, given that, there is a moral hierarchy that comes out of it. And the moral hierarchy says that there's a correlation between morality and authority, that the people who are most moral should rule. And the way you find that out in a well-ordered world is by looking how it has worked out over time. So the assumption is that there's a hierarchy, which is God over man, man over nature, the rich over the poor, employers over employees, adults over children, Western culture over non-Western culture, our country over other countries. And then it goes on in ways that are even less nice, which is whites over non-whites, you know, the women over men over women, straights over gays, Christians over non-Christians. So when you go through that hierarchy and you look at it, you can see that all of the Republican presidential candidates have most of that hierarchy. It's very common out there. And the reason that has moved in that direction, where you have more and more voters and more candidates doing this, has to do with the Gingrich Revolution way back in 1994, which tried to get people who were moderate Republicans not nominated around the country. And what helped a lot in that is the power of the conservative church. That is, when you have evangelical Christians, white evangelical Christians out there, and they have power locally to say who gets nominated and who doesn't around the country in their districts, then what that means is that that their version of strict father morality wins. And that you can have strict father morality without being religious, but if you are interested in religion, you're going to pick evangelical Christianity because they have a strict father God. I mean, their view of God is, you know, here's my commandments. You do as I say, you go to heaven. Otherwise, you get burned in hell for eternity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty strict.
Well, but how does this apply, though, to Donald Trump, George Lakoff, in as much as he is certainly a strict father or image, I guess, but he's more of an alpha male, and particularly up against those two sort of yapping other candidates. He was like the big dog in the middle the last time they were on stage together, and his morality is certainly being questioned.
Well, the point is that he does not have the Christian morality. He's not a Christian. In fact, he makes fun of it. He makes fun of, you know, of doing Christian rituals and so on.
But they vote for him, though, don't they? They're voting for him in droves.
And the reason they're voting for him is this. They became conservative Christians because they had strict father morality, not because they started out being in the religion. And so the fact that they have strict father morality first is saying, hey, they're going to vote for Trump. You know, and it's an easy explanation. I mean, very simple. Mm. That's why they're in that religion, given that they're interested in religion. That's the one they would choose. But then that religion itself has other additional things going with it if you choose that. Now, establishment Republicans depend on that. Establishment Republicans depend upon the positions that come out of that, like being against abortion, getting rid of Planned Parenthood, you know, not having sex education, and on and on. So there, that given that, you know, that group, you're going to get that version of strict father morality coming from establishment Republicans, but not Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is a very different kind of version of strict father morality, which is very common. Namely, he is a pragmatic conservative as opposed to a religious conservative. And as a pragmatic strict father, he, you know, that what that says is you want to be in charge, be in authority in your domain, whatever it is, you know, in your household, in your business, whatever it is, you want to be in charge, and he wants to be in charge and have those strict father principles. Now, if you do that, things change, because it's not like the religious version in all kinds of ways, or the establishment Republican version in all kinds of ways. For example, take sex. You know, if you are a pragmatic conservative, you have no problem having sex without marriage, having sex with someone you don't want to marry. It could be a man, you could be male or female and have those views. No problem. Now, what the only problem is if somebody gets pregnant. Well, then it's very convenient to have Planned Parenthood around. Planned Parenthood will get contraceptives, have abortions if you need them, which is the extreme, but also teach you about cervical cancer, give you sex education without anybody knowing it, and with it being cheap. It doesn't cost. So, you know, if you're a pragmatic conservative, you'd like Planned Parenthood. And Donald Trump does. He doesn't want to ban Planned Parenthood. You know, very important. Now, he also doesn't want to ban, you know, Medicare and, you know, and Social Security. Why? If you're a pragmatic conservative and you're middle-aged, you have, and you have elderly parents, it's a hell of a lot cheaper on you, if you have responsibility for your parents, to have Medicare and Social Security, which will pay for them. It's to your profit to do that. It means that you can do more for yourself. Straightforward things. Donald Trump understands all of those pragmatic conservatives out there throughout the country are going to want to have to continue Medicare. You know, they don't want the government taking their Medicare away, and, you know, and so on. So they're going to, you know, they're going to want that. And so that's one. Those are among the things that you've got to consider. That this is a these are pragmatic conservatives, not religious conservatives, and they're going to have somewhat different views. Now that's the first part. There's more to this. One thing that mystifies people are a lot of his positions, and they're not mysterious at all. You know, why does he want to build a wall? Why does he want to have huge tariffs? Why does he want to, you know, just deport people and so on? Why does he say those things? It's actually a very, you know, predictable thing. One thing we know from looking at this and stuff I've written, but also that Elizabeth Vailing has done research on, is that conservatives use direct rather than systemic causation much more often in their reasoning. Direct causation is like, you know, you pick up a cup of water, you take a drink, you do something, there's some desire or need that occurs, you do it directly, you do something right away. Systemic causation says, you know, there's a complicated system going on here, and you gotta think about it. So if you're a nurturing parent, you gotta talk to your kid, understand what the kid needs, you know, raise the kid in the appropriate way, explain why you're doing what you're doing. There's a whole system that you've gotta deal with all the time. And so when you have direct causation in conservative thought, what you're going to do is get conservatives thinking, yes, we need direct solutions. So if there are a lot of Mexicans coming over the border, you build a wall. You know, if it costs too much, you make them pay. You know, if there are 11 million immigrants who've come into the country without papers and are working here and people think they're taking their jobs, you know, because they're doing well and honest, okay, folks, what you do, you just say, deport them, get rid of them, poof, like that. if you're worried about terrorism and terrorists coming in from Muslim countries, you say, don't let any Muslims in. You know, direct causation. If you are worried about, you know, the economic power of China, you say, put a tariff on China. You know, not worrying about the consequences of doing that. And so on. For case after case after case, he gives the direct causation solution without looking at any of the systemic properties of this. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what you get all over the place. But it fits very well with other people who have versions of strict father morality. And let's face it, I mean, if you look at the number of people who voted Republican in recent elections, there are tens of millions of them. They're right out there. Well, they're, you know, 45-47% voted Republican. You know, there are probably, 30% of the population who are very strong strict father Republicans. So he's going to resonate with those guys. So that's one thing, which is direct causation. The next has to do with that moral hierarchy. When you go down the hierarchy, you get notions like bigotry. You get, men over women, whites over non-whites, our religion over other religions, etc. You get bigotry. Well, the fact is that there are a lot of people in the country who have those feelings. And they're not very popular if you say them out loud. It's very difficult for people around the country to come out and say those things. The code word for this is political correctness. That is, they feel oppressed by views that are opposed to them that say we should be care about equality of opportunity, men and women should be equal, whites and non-whites should be equal, all religions should be equal, etc. A lot of people don't believe that but can't say it. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump can say it. And when he says it, he says, because I'm saying it, and I'm winning, I can in this domination race, I can say it and I can make it sound legitimate. And not only that, if you support me, you don't have to say it because I'm saying it already.
Right. So, well, George Legoff, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff, who's a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California in Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Whaling. And his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back exploring some historical comparisons to a possibly divided Republican Party heading into the 2016 election.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Reynolds, a distinguished professor of English and American Studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review and the author or editor of 15 books, including most recently Lincoln's Selected Writings. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Reynolds.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
And, of course, David, there's a world of difference between Abraham Lincoln, arguably America's greatest president, and Donald Trump, who may well be on his way to becoming president. Do you find this particular election year, well, I was going to say appalling, but how do you find it in the context of history?
Well, it is kind of appalling just because of the level of rhetoric Now, we've had a lot of really mean elections in the past, and sometimes insults are traded. But it seems to me that there's a kind of desperation in the air. When Lincoln was elected in 1860, he was an outsider, in a sense, because he wasn't very well known. But because there was such incredible polarization in the country over slavery at that time, the Democrats divided. And so there were three parties in the end opposing Lincoln's Republican Party. And even though his three opponents actually got more votes, popular votes, than Lincoln, still he won in the Electoral College. And so he won the election. But it was a time when polarization really threatened the party system. And today we have such political polarization where inertia in Congress as a result of the division between the Republicans and the Democrats, and then the polarization between the 1% and the rest of us, this has really created an instability in the political scene. And that's why we have a phenomenon like Donald Trump. And even Bernie Sanders, who's, even though he's not an outsider in the sense of being outside politics, he's somewhat outside of normal politics, self-identified as a democratic socialist. So you have, in a sense, two outliers that are really created by this incredible polarization.
But when you say, though, the inertia in Congress, obviously you're referring to gridlock, and
yes,
the gridlock is largely caused by the Republicans. I mean, that was their stated strategy. That's what Mitch McConnell said as soon as Obama got elected. We're going to make sure he's a one-term president. So isn't it a bit ironic that the disgust that the electorate obviously feels towards politicians that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are tapping into is essentially caused by the Republicans? And it would be a great irony that the Republicans won because of their own obstruction.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that the obstructionism by the Republican Congress ends up by electing an outsider like Donald Trump. That could well happen, because what happens is that since Washington is all gummed up, people want to look for some liberator, and Donald Trump, to many people, looks like a liberator when actually the Orthodox Republicans, the Republican leadership and establishment, doesn't particularly like Donald Trump and is even thinking of ways of possibly stopping him, either in a brokered convention or in a there's even talk of running somebody else under a kind of a third party, and so there's this whole Stop Trump movement, a lot of it linked to the Republicans themselves, because he's not being seen as representative of the party leadership. Now, the Orthodox Republican Party leadership is reflected by Congress itself, and Congress is very obstructionist. The Republican Congress is very obstructionist and just doesn't want to deal on the Supreme Court nominee or even consider one. That's just the latest example of many of Obama's ideas along the way that they've just automatically said they're not going to even really consider seriously. And, of course, that's not how the democratic system is supposed to work. There is supposed to be give and take. And the reason I bring back Lincoln is that he, in his situation, the Congress people were literally coming to the halls of Congress armed with weapons and guns and everything. It got very, very bad. And it got so bad at that time that 11 states actually seceded from the Union. They left the Union. And then we had the bloody Civil War. Now, we're not going to have a Civil War here. I'm not talking about that. But we're having right now a very, very deep political war. And it really makes life uncertain as to what's going to happen. I mean, it kind of looks like Trump will probably win the Republican nomination, almost certainly. But then there'll be a lot of angry conservative Republicans out there, and gosh only knows what's going to happen at that point.
So just to follow on with the Lincoln analogy here in terms of the divided opposition amongst the Democrats that benefited Lincoln and the possibility of a divided Republican Party, already you're starting to see that. I mean, first of all, just with the candidates that you have, you've got Donald Trump ahead, Ted Cruz basically now saying to the what's left of the Republican establishment, saying, hey, I'm the only one that can beat Trump. And then you got Marco Rubio, who continues to say that he's doing well, even though he's only won one state so far, and seems to be able to sort of say if second and third place finishes a victory, that's going to get harder and harder for him. And he's clearly the one that the establishment anointed. So do you think that they're going to switch now to Cruz and hope that they can somehow bolster him? Or you've mentioned other scenarios, too, of a brokered convention and a possible third party. So walk us through those scenarios.
Yeah, well, my feeling is that, you know, the Republicans, the party leaders, fairly soon would have to use whatever pressure they can to have one candidate kind of emerge. Now, whether it be Cruz, whether it be Rubio, I think Rubio is more anointed because Cruz himself, of course, is a little bit of an outsider within the Senate in terms of the establishment. Although Cruz has won three states now, and Rubio, I think, has won one. Is that right? Yeah. So I think that Cruz might be the likely choice, but I think the only hope of defeating Trump would be for it doesn't appear that this is going to happen, but for people like Kasich and particularly Rubio and Carson to be either pressured to remove by the powers that be, or sort of voluntarily remove themselves, so that somehow, I guess it would be Cruz left standing, since he has won more states than the others, and that presumably then he would gather at least some, if not most or many, of the votes of the other candidates. Going forward, I think that's really the only way the Republicans will do it. I don't think a so-called third party would work at this point. I think it's really sort of too late for that.
But in terms of getting Rubio to step down or Kasich to step down, both of which are unlikely, they're unlikely because it seems nowadays the politicians themselves, and in particular people like Donald Trump who are outsiders, there's no party control over them. It feels like the parties have lost control of the candidates.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, all the candidates to some degree are sort of loose cannons, so to speak, and it's even reflected in the level of rhetoric that has been flying right now. Now, this is not at all orthodox Republican rhetoric. It's not the normal kind of political rhetoric that is used in party campaigns, in normal conventional party campaigns. But in that sense, Donald Trump has sort of opened up the rhetoric in ways that are certainly lively and sometimes forceful and sometimes effective, but also quite often rather nasty. And it's real gutter rhetoric and schoolyard rhetoric. So the rhetoric itself kind of reflects the kind of anti-party sentiment. And so that even people that are anointed by the party, like a Rubio or like a Jeb Bush or something like, well, Bush is now out of it, but even they are kind of resorting to non-traditional techniques just to try to upset Donald Trump. And so far, it hasn't really worked. I think that Donald Trump maybe was chastened a little bit last night because he perhaps didn't win as many states as he kind of expected. He was sort of he was saying things like, 7, 8, 9, and kind of mounting up the numbers, and that didn't really work out. So it could be that there is a little bit of a backlash, perhaps created by the the kind of non-traditional methods that people like Rubio and to some degree Cruz now are using. So unfortunately, sometimes it does take negative campaigning to, you know, to make an impact, particularly when Trump himself has sort of begun all of this.
Well, it seems for the longest time we've had a kind of game show democracy where so much is, of the process is celebrated by the media, but not with very little substance and context. But now we're morphing from a game show democracy into a reality show democracy.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah, the game show is being replaced by the reality show where people are so accustomed to watching some forms of verbal violence or emotional outpouring on reality shows and unpredictable behavior that these speeches, particularly Trump's speeches and to some degree now Rubio's speeches even, are turning into kind of reality contests where just the immediate sensation, the immediate moment, and what kind of, and how much you can rile up the audience and have the yell and scream and cheer and everything, that is much more important than even kind of the game show mentality. And it's very, very distant from, let's say, the Lincoln-Douglas debates back in the 50s, where one guy would speak for an hour and a half about real substantive issues. I mean, real on issues, not on personalities. And then the other guy would speak for an hour and a half, and then the other guy would respond for an hour, and then the other guy would respond for an hour. And the audience was just glued on every word, but it was totally on the issues. And it was not about any of this ad hominem, you know, personal mudslinging or anything like that. So it's very, very different.
But arguably, in contrast, the Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, are at least conducting a more traditional campaign in the way that you just described the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where, you know, they are talking about substance, and it's not there's been a little bit of personal animus, but not very, very little. By and large, they've stuck to the issues. The real question then is, David Reynolds, where is the electorate at? Is the electorate so corrupted by game shows, reality shows, social media, that they want this kind of cage fight, or do they want substance?
Yeah, well, that's going to come out in the general election. I have confidence. I hope that we'll get back to the issues on both sides. I think the Democrats certainly have sustained a discussion of the issues far more than the Republicans, and I hope the general election will get back to that. And it just matters the degree to which Hillary, who presumably will be the nominee, whether Hillary decides to that she has to cast herself into the gutter as well somehow, because Donald Trump has said things like, oh, Hillary should be in jail. And he's sort of starting the low rhetoric right now. And the big question mark will be whether Hillary will sort of descend to commenting on whatever, the KKK thing or the racism or his business, something about his business dealings or his taxes or this, that, and the other. And, I mean, I hope it's not that way. I imagine that there'll be more of that kind of thing than there was in the last presidential race or in previous presidential races, because just with Donald Trump being there, and you can rest assured that he will go on the attack. I mean, there's very little doubt about that. So it really depends on Hillary's response. I don't think she'll kind of stoop as low as Rubio is doing right now in some of his jokes about bodily functions and this, that, and the other. But I think it'll be sort of a lower rhetoric than we're accustomed to in most presidential campaigns.
Well, part of the strategy there to gum up the works on the Republican side comes from the very people who fund the Republican Party and control our politics, and that is the oligarchs, the very people that Bernie Sanders is trying to point out are really running the country and have totally corrupted our politics. So, I mean, there's no accident that the Republican mantra is that big government is the problem, because big business wants to basically have no checks and balances against them.
Yeah, well, that's why Bernie has aroused so much enthusiasm. And it also is involved in the whole Supreme Court decision, because if you get a super conservative in there, let's pretend you get a conservative, that conservative would probably uphold Citizens United and maybe even add to it or something like that, whereas I believe a liberal court would take a different look at Citizens United and would overturn that, and that would make a big difference. And then any kind and a democratic president would try to strengthen the regulations on Wall Street and also sort of clamp down on the super PACs and so forth. So and all of that would be for the good. Why? Because a lot of those Republican Congress people were elected by being funded by very, very wealthy, super conservative organizations, and they have to toe the party line. They have to do what these organizations have told them to do, and they can only vote a certain way, and if they don't vote that way, then they're sort of excommunicated.
Sure.
So it's kind of a they're kind of in the freeze hold of these capitalists. So we really need a kind of that needs to be broken up, that whole freeze hold on the part of these wealthy institutions who are funding these super conservative congressmen.
Well, David Reynolds, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Reynolds, who's a distinguished professor of English and American Studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review and the author or editor of 15 books, including most recently Lincoln's Selected Writings. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.